Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery. This is a breaking news alert live from the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service.
An important meeting is set for Wednesday night, August 14th, on the future of fire services in the Rural Fire Protection District, which serves many communities in East County. The County Fire Authority is threatening to withdraw all fire service funding if the San Diego Rural Fire Protection District chooses to remain an independent fire district and not merge with the County Fire Authority. If the district stays independent, funding will revert back to 2007 levels, with no pay for firefighters for rural stations, according to a letter sent by the district's fire board to residents. The meeting will be held at 7 o'clock in the evening on Wednesday, August 14th, at Old Ironside Park, located at 326 Harbison Canyon Road in El Cajon. Rural Fire Protection District is the latest in a string of fire districts in unincorporated areas of the county to face takeover by the County Fire Authority. Some, such as Julian Quirmack Fire District, have opted against the consolidation and found outside funding to fill the gap, while others have opted for consolidation with mixed results. Ostensibly intended to improve fire safety in the wake of the Cedar Fire, the consolidation has had unintended consequences, including dark days and unmanned stations in some communities. The Rural Fire Protection District's board has issued a statement of options before residents. You can find their statement at eastcountymagazine.org. You can also find the county's arguments in favor of consolidation at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery, and my guest today is Rick Halsey, who is the director of the Chaparral Institute. Welcome, Rick.
Hi, Miriam.
In recent years, controlled burns have been a major part of California's strategy for preventing wildfires. But now, the Chaparral Institute has completed a study which had some interesting findings suggesting this may not be the best strategy. Rick, tell us what you concluded.
The most pervasive perspective most people have, in fact, you see it in every newspaper article about fires, is that fire suppression in the past by firefighters has allowed an unnatural amount of vegetation to grow up throughout the entire state. So when you have these big fires, it's always blamed on past fire suppression efforts. And basically what you're saying is the firefighters are the ones that caused the problem that they're trying to extinguish. And the data now that we've collected, there's been five major research papers done by different scientists over the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And we've done a significant review of those papers. And consistently what they've all found is that fire suppression in shrubland ecosystems, now we're talking about chaparral, coastal sage scrub.
So not necessarily pine forest,
right,
but chaparral
right.
specifically.
Which are the most dominant ecosystems in California. Mm-hmm. In Southern California, those ecosystems are not impacted at all by fire suppression. In other words, the amount of vegetation out there is a natural byproduct of their natural processes.
So a controlled burn does not help to prevent fire. Can it make it worse?
Yes. The problem we're seeing right now is there are so many fires on the landscape, more fires than the ecosystems can tolerate, which is also contrary to what most people believe, is that if you add more fire to the landscape in the form of a controlled burn, for example, like they did in the San Felipe Valley this last May.
Which was a controlled burn that quickly got out of control. I believe it burned 3,000 acres. It was only supposed to burn 100.
Yeah, a couple thousand acres there. And what happened was, the wind picked up and it took off. That area had been burned by the 2002 Pines fire. And so you had a repeat fire frequency here of a little more than 10 years. The ecosystem cannot tolerate that kind of fire return interval. And what happens is the shrubs, the ecosystem itself can't recover. And so there's not enough seeds in the soil. The underground burrows for the plants don't have enough starch to resprout. So something has to fill the void. And ultimately what that is weeds.
So you get grasses coming
yes.
up where you used to have shrubs, chaparral, bushes, and other things.
Exactly. And those weeds are much more flammable. They extend the fire season by several months. So what you've done, you replaced one form of quote-unquote fuel with another form, which is much more flammable. In fact, it's the most dangerous kind of fire you can have as a grass fire. The fire that's spreading up in the banning area this week here has been spreading at 1,000 acres an hour, and a lot of that has to do with the fact that that area had burned in the 2006 Esperanza fire. Well, what's really been filling in the void up there is grasses, and grasses burn so fast.
And yet CAL FIRE has proposed to dramatically increase controlled burns. Do you happen to have the statistics on that?
Well, they are basically, with this new proposal, targeting a third of the entire state of California for what they call vegetation treatment.
Third of the state. That is astounding.
They're not going to actually do a third, but that's what's in their sights. So
potentially.
Yes. The problem with this is they've decided to basically treat all of California, all ecosystems, as if they're forests, when in fact the highest fire danger and the highest fire risk in California are in shrublands in Southern California. You cannot treat them like forests. It's a whole different ecosystem.
Why are chaparral ecosystems important for our region and for our environment?
Chaparral is probably, I think, the closest, most intact place you can experience nature for most Californians. It's right next door. It's in the park nearby. And it's really a beautiful wildlife-intensive area that people can go out and enjoy the natural environment.
How would these controlled burns impact wildlife? That seems like an awfully large number of acres of a particular habitat to burn.
Well, once you burn an area, if it's been repeatedly burned in the past, ultimately you remove all the biodiversity and you replace it with a weed patch. And so you'll get some grasshoppers and maybe a few coyotes running through, but you've effectively destroyed the source that allows the biodiversity to exist.
Now, you presented your research, I understand, at a California Board of Forestry hearing, CAL FIRE, August 8th up in Ventura. How did that go?
We had a representative there at the hearing, and the Board of Forestry right now is reviewing the proposal to do this targeted vegetation treatment plan, and there was public testimony, and we were there, presented documents, and we also gave a full report on our San Felipe Escape Fire report.
Mm-hmm. What was the reaction that was received?
Well, when you talk to a board of any kind, it's typically pretty benign, and there's not much reaction, and that was up there as well, from my understanding. But a lot of information was passed along, and we're hoping the board will continue its effort to collaborate with all the fire scientists, all the natural history experts, the environmental groups, because fire is a statewide issue, and it involves all of us. And so all of us need to be involved in trying to resolve the issue.
Have you met with elected officials on your findings?
Yes, I've. We've pretty much met with everybody, and it's.
Is there anyone who's taking this up or championing this cause?
Politically, no. It seems to be left to the agencies for the most part. Unfortunately, when big fires occur, there's a big interest level and money's thrown at the problem. And the problem is, most of the time, what they do is just try to fund vegetation treatment projects, which we've been doing for the last 100 years.
Is it a penny-wise, pound-foolish thing, do you think, in this era of budget cuts where we've seen firefighting budgets cut? Are they thinking this is just, you know, a cheaper way to forestall this?
It's politically the most effective way to go about it, but it's not the most effective way to do it.
To prevent. In other words, they may just be setting us up for larger and more expensive fires down the road.
Well, what happens, you have to ask the question, what are you trying to do when you're talking about reducing fire risk? You're trying to protect lives and property. So how do you do that? And the research has clearly shown the best way to do that is to fire-harden communities, which means retrofit structures that are not properly safe. For example, ember-resistant vents. Mm-hmm. Do proper defensible space, which does not mean 300 feet of clear-cut dirt. It means thinning the vegetation in a way that will allow the vegetation that's properly irrigated to act as an ember catcher and a heat sink. And so these areas that have cleared massive amounts of land around homes, often these places go up in smoke because they've created basically an alleyway for embers to fly and hit the house. So there's a whole sort of list of things you can do around, in, and on the communities themselves in order to make them fire safe. And that then becomes a permanent solution instead of going out in the landscape and continually whacking nature when, in fact, all it's going to do is going to create a weedy environment, which is even more flammable.
Very interesting. Now, where can people go to get more information about this, and are there any actions that you recommend folks who may be concerned about this issue could take?
Sure. We have a website. It's californiachaparral.org, and that's one P and two R's. Mm-hmm. You can type in California Chaparral, and ultimately you'll find the Institute's name there. So people can go to our website. It's www.california, all spelled out, Chaparral, that's chaparral.org. And that's the California Chaparral Institute's website. And we have a page specifically called Protecting Your Home, which has all the data, all the science, and a lot of resources for you to do the right thing.
Very good. Rick, thank you so much for being here and sharing this extremely important information with our listeners here on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso.
Thank you.
But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly.
This is Leon Thompson, and I'm here with Raylene Nicole, a promising young musician from East County. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. Yeah, so I grew up my whole life in East County, my whole 18 years of life. We've moved around a lot, but basically it's been the same two freeway exits the whole time. I went to elementary school, middle school, Boston Valley, and then Las Coches Creek, and then I went to high school, Granite Hills, and I just graduated.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, I first heard you at the Coyote Music Festival at Cuyamaca College. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was a really fun experience. That was the first music festival I've ever been a part of, and I had no idea that I was actually going to be in that. And one day I was at Starbucks in Rancho San Diego. They have an open mic, so I was at the open mic. Then I happened to walk in to grab a Starbucks, and on the little bulletin board, they had like a little flyer saying, oh, musicians need it. I'm like, oh, that's me. I think it was a website, and I looked on and it was the music festival, and I'm like, that would be super cool. And they were having tryouts, so I went to the tryouts, and it was really intimidating because I walked in and I was still a senior in high school, so it's all these college kids in this big giant like performance hall, so, like with a stage and chairs, like theater looking. And so I was on the stage all by myself, me and my guitar, and then all these people in the seats. Part of their class was to judge the auditions, so they're all staring at me with papers, writing down notes. I had no idea what they were writing, and they're all looking up at me every now and then. So, and then I started playing, and one guy in the front, I remember, was like dancing to it, so I felt a lot better. I was like, okay, they like it. I'm not going to die. So, and then I think they emailed me or called me back. They really liked your audition. We'd like to have you play at the festival. So my drummer, Kimo, and I just got together, practiced a little bit, came up with the set, and then we got to play, and it was so much fun. It was the coolest thing. It was, you know, it was a really nice day, so everyone was out there on blankets, like with picnics, and there was like tons of little booths around, and I think it was only their second or third annual. It was really new, so I'm sure it's going to even get bigger and bigger every year. So the students were running everything. That's a really cool class, you know, to teach kids to run a festival. That's something that you don't learn every day. There was a lot of other musicians and bands, and they had face painting. I got to get my face painted and snow cones and just little vendors and everything. So it was a really cool way to bring the whole college area community together.
Speaking of your music, how would you describe it?
I would describe my music as like a relaxing summer playlist, you know, when you're driving in the car. I have some upbeat songs that really get people going. I'm a typical teenage girl, so what else am I going to write about rather than, you know, the boy I have a crush on or something? So a lot of my songs are about that kind of feeling when you don't really know the person too well, but you can't wait to see what happens in the future. And I think that's one of the funnest feelings ever, is like the feeling of possibility or who knows what's going to come. You know, I really like this guy and he, you know, I don't know what's going to happen, but I like him. That's all I know. I have a couple other ones. They're also upbeat, and I'm trying to write more of these songs lately because it's how I feel, and it's more just about believing in yourself and not really listening to negative people, or, you know, just positive sort of things, and just about good feelings, and sounds like rainbows, butterflies kind of thing. But, you know, I like that. So I like inspiring people to believe in themselves and go for what they really want to do rather than just be sad. But then on the other hand, I do have a couple sad songs that are extremely sad. So, but I think that's kind of what I like to make myself relatable, saying, you know, I understand how they feel, or like certain feelings that people don't like to touch on. But if the lyrics can understand how they're feeling, I think people like that and they'll relate to that and want to listen to that more. Yeah.
Can you do one of your songs for us?
Yes, I can. Is that the one?
Pouring Down.
Yes, I can.
All right. Thank you. Let's hear that.
So much more I haven't told you. There's so much more that you don't know. And everything's so new, but just trust me and I'll trust you. I've still got so much more of me to show. You've got those eyes that make me wonder. I wonder if you feel the way I do. Now I can't concentrate and it's your fault. I can't think straight, just tell me if your hands are shaking too. We're not too sure about anything, but honestly for me, that's okay. Kiss me in the rain out where it's pouring down, but I don't care, I'm giving up and I'm so scared to let you in. But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly. Now how come everything's so beautiful when I'm with you? The way we laugh on accident. I think I'm going under as we dance to the flash of thunder. We're so cool, we won't go inside just yet. We're not too sure about anything, but honestly for me, that's okay. You kiss me in the rain out where it's pouring down, but I don't care, I'm giving up and I'm so scared to let you in. But all I know is this feels right when we're under the stars tonight. These butterflies that I can't fight, so I'll just let them fly.
Thank you, Ray Lee.
You're welcome.
So what's coming up in your career? What is next for Ray Lee?
The next thing I really want to do is record a full album, 12-song album, mix of, you know, happy and sad ones. I still need a couple more songs before I do that, but I want to record that album, kind of tour around the country, kind of the poor musician's tour where I, you know, get in my own car and drive around, but hey, a tour is a tour. Just spread the music and see, you know, how far I can get it to go.
How did you get your musical training?
I have been taking piano lessons ever since I was 5 years old, and then I went all the way until high school started, so up till I was 15, so it was 10 years of piano lessons, and then I did, I think, like a week or two of vocal lessons when I was in middle school or something, and I didn't like it very much, and then even back then, I wasn't trying to sing, I just went to lessons just because, but I never really started singing until after my freshman year in high school, and that's when I started playing guitar as well, because my grandparents got me a guitar for Christmas during my freshman year, and then I didn't really do much with it. I learned a couple chords, and then that was that, and then then after my freshman year of high school, during that summer, I think I put up my first YouTube video and all my friends were like, oh my God. Now I look back on it and I'm like, oh, that was not very good at all. But back then, I mean, I got tons of praise for it. So I was like, okay, if I can hide on the computer screen and they like it, now I can go in person and maybe they'll like it too. So I started to play covers at local coffee shops and things like that in South Park and North Park, City Heights area. I started writing originals and playing those. And then that got me to go up and produce the EP and everything. And I never took any guitar lessons. It was really just, if you really, really want to learn something, you'll figure out a way to teach yourself. You will learn it. And especially today with the internet, it was so easy. I was on YouTube all the time. UltimateGuitar.com was a blessing because once you learn how to read, because I used the book to teach myself to read chords and tab. And then once I could do that, I could get on Ultimate Guitar. And then each song had chords and tabs with it. And I was like, okay, well, now I can play the song. I would play it like 5 hours a day, like so much. And so I think I learned quickly. It kind of kickstarted a lot of time. I compacted it into one summer. But yeah, I never took lessons. I just used YouTube videos and online everything.
So. We're really glad that you did.
Thanks.
your voice is lovely and sweet.
Thank you.
And I like your chord progressions and changes and the range. It's just beautiful. So
thank
really
you so
appreciate
much.
You coming in
Thank
and talking
you.
To us.
Thanks.
We've been speaking to Raylee Nicole. So how can people reach you if they want to hear some more of your music?
Well, I'm on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, all those social network things that everyone likes to go on. Just look up Raylee Nicole, which is R-A-E-L-E-E. That's Raylee. And then Nicole is N-I-K-O-L-E. And then I have a website, www.RayleeNicole.com. www.RayleeNicole.com.
Thank you so much, Raylee.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm interviewing Ken Culkin. My guest is an award-winning author of 10 books and recipient of a National Endowment of the Arts Fellowship. Ken's writing has also appeared in dozens of magazines, including Esquire, Best American Short Stories, and the San Diego Reader. Welcome, Ken. It's a pleasure to see you.
Hello. It's nice to be here.
Ken, you have a long history of writing everything from columns to short stories to your own novels, as well as mysteries co-authored with local writer Alan Russell. Which projects would you say that you enjoy the most and why?
The biggest amount of time that I've spent, and so I just enjoy writing. So my primary project over the years, for about the last 20 years actually, has been a series that began with a book called The Loud Adios. That's A-D-I-O-S, like in Spanish, only usually the accent mark is left off by mistake. From there, it just sort of transformed itself into a series in which I am able to explore this character, this Tom Hickey fellow, all the way from his childhood all the way until he is a very old man, and also his family, his son and his adopted son and his two wives and other historical characters all factor into different novels. And so I get to explore these characters and they grow in my mind and my knowledge about the historical characters grow a lot. So I just get a kick out of learning about the history of California, which is where they're all set, over the 20th century, and I just love dealing with the characters and the history.
So you're learning more about the real world and the world you created.
Both, yeah. I'm not sure that they're different, but sometimes they run together.
They merge.
Yes.
Your book, In Writing and the Spirit, offers guidance and inspiration to other writers. What would you say is your main advice, and have you received any feedback from the San Diego writing community about it?
My main advice is to read the book, because there's a whole lot of stuff in there, and I can't say that any one piece of advice is right for everybody by any means, because the feedback that I've gotten, and I certainly have gotten quite a bit from San Diego and elsewhere, is that this part really spoke to me. It's a sort of a series of meditations, just a couple of pages long, that offer, you know, different insights into the subject of mostly about inspiration and how we can get inspired and how we can open our minds and free our minds and be ready to listen to the muse or the spirit or whatever we want to call it.
What inspires you? How do you listen to the muse?
The example that comes most readily to mind this morning, I get a lot of ideas in the bathtub, actually.
Oh.
Yeah, which is why I generally take baths instead of showers. and also on walks. But this morning I realized there was a character named Leslie White, who was an actual detective investigator for the Los Angeles District Attorney's Office, and he just plays a very bit part because I wanted to get in some information, and he was a good guy to give this information. Mm-hmm. And then I have another character that I have been wondering what to do with. He's somebody that's following Tom Hickey throughout the novel and sometimes following his sister, Florence. So I didn't know who he was following and why he was doing this, and so I hadn't dealt with that yet. But it occurred to me this morning that he's following him at the behest of this fellow, Leslie White. So although Tom, well, I'm not going to go into what happens beyond that because I would give some stuff away. I don't want to. But the one thing led to another. The character led me to Leslie White, which led me to the reason why this guy is following him. And it opened up some distinct possibilities that could answer some questions about some thorny problems that I still have to solve in the novel.
So it's like unraveling a ball of string.
Mm-hmm. It all fell together in about 10 different pieces from one particular idea.
What fun.
Mm-hmm.
Well, going back to the mysteries that you co-authored with Alan Russell, I know they have the intriguing titles of Roadkill and No Cats, No Chocolate, and that they're about the madness of book tours. Is there a story behind the story? I mean, are book tours really mad?
Well, book tours are mad when Alan and I are on them. I'm not sure that everybody else is quite as mad as we are, but we're both pretty ornery, and we like to argue. And, and if anything is tedious, then our imaginations spring to life, and no telling what could happen. So they're very mad. But a story that I like to tell is when the title, No Cats, No Chocolate, came from a book signing we were doing. It was in Boulder, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And the bookseller said, hey, would you guys like to make some money, big money? And we said, well, you know, we're not, we know, yeah. And he said, write a book called The Cat Who Would Die for Chocolate, because cats and chocolate were big in the mystery genre at the time. Well, Alan and I thought of ourselves as a step above writers who would capitalize on such mundane stuff as mm-hmm. chocolate and cats, and we didn't see ourselves as commercial as all that. So we decided to write this book and go the absolute opposite way and call it No Cats, No Chocolate. Now, recently, it was quite a bestseller on Amazon in the ebook. We were number one in the Oprah category.
Wow.
and in the Midwest travel and in the West Coast travel, because we're on our way to be on Oprah in one of the books, and then No Cats, No Chocolate. So what we did when we were promoting the book is we asked a bunch of writer friends to write the nastiest comments they could possibly write about us. And so they did. So we have a lot of famous writers that are saying just awful things about how degraded and what reprobates we are. So when a lot of people started reading that book, I got notes from friends that were just lamenting the fact that these people would have such awful things to say about us. So I really got a kick out of that, because I had not realized that anybody was quite capable of thinking that an author, if they got comments like that, would actually put it in their book. So I was baffled and a bit chagrined by the fact that I think I don't know as much about the human mind as I thought I did before that, if they're capable of making that mistake. So.
Well, it sounds like you have a great time overall with this.
I do. I love it.
So, last question. What is your next writing project, and when do you think we'll see it?
Well, I'm hoping it'll be out in spring with Poison Pen Press. It's called The Good Know Nothing, and it's the second chronologically and the seventh actual book of the Hickey family series that I mentioned. It involves the Sundance Kid and Tom Hickey, of course, and it's set in 1936, right during mm-hmm. the Nazi Olympics. It also features B. Traven, that wrote The Treasure of Sierra Madre, and Wave Randolph Hearst and Marion Davies, and there's some other celebrity. Amy mm-hmm. Semple McPherson factors into it, the old-time preacher. So I'm just having fun. And now that I've solved these things that I solved this morning because of that one idea leading to others, I should be done with it sometime in July, and it should come out next spring.
Okay, well, we look forward to seeing it. Our time is up, Ken, but thanks again for joining us. For more information on Ken Culkin, and that's Kuhlken, please visit his website at www.kenculkin.net. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
Thank you.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interests, the people's interests, not special interest. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, your network for social justice.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with KNSJ's East County Magazine show, and my newsmaker today is Aaron Hunt, with the California Wolf Center in Julian. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Thank you for having me. I'm happy to be here.
This facility has done an amazing job of bringing back from near extinction a particular breed of wolf. We're going to tell you more about that later. There are several thousand gray wolves across the United States today. But Erin is here with some very troubling news today. She's going to tell us about a National Day of Action on August 14th to stand up for gray wolves because the federal government's U.S. Department of Interior and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are pushing to delist gray wolves from protection under the Federal Endangered Species Act. Erin, tell us what's happening.
The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to delist gray wolves throughout the lower 48 states.
So they would no longer be endangered or even on the threatened list. What would happen?
Management would be handed over to each individual state where wolves are found, and the states have various different attitudes towards gray wolves. Some of them are opposed to having gray wolves in their states. So this proposal, if it goes through, has the potential to put the brakes on wolf recovery. Wolf recovery is one of the most successful endangered species recovery efforts in our nation's history. And we believe it would be premature to remove protections for gray wolves at this time.
This could even open the door to hunting them by helicopters, as we've seen done in Alaska with Alaskan gray wolves, correct?
Well, there are areas of this country that have excellent wolf habitat, but either have very small populations of gray wolves or don't have any populations of gray wolves. So to consider wolves recovered in areas where they're not even found is premature. So it would prevent wolves from recolonizing those areas that have good habitat. In the areas where we do have healthy populations of wolves, most likely effect would be to reduce those populations and potentially even eliminate populations.
Now, one of the most disturbing aspects of this story is an interview that you have done with a scientist, Dr. Vucetich, who was one of 16 scientists whose work was cited to try to justify this proposal for the delisting. And yet he and these other scientists have now signed a letter critiquing the arguments and saying that the federal government is effectively stacking the deck of what should be an independent peer review process and excluding those scientists who are really the top wolf experts. What can you tell us about your findings from your interview with Dr. Vucetich?
Well, this is a big concern because the way science works is that experts, peers, must review other scientists' work. That's how science gets better. It's how we find new information and how we continually improve.
Correct.
So to tell scientists that no, you can't make judgments and you can't critique another scientist's work is exactly the opposite of the way science is supposed to function. In this particular case, it's potential evidence of stacking the deck against science. if an independent peer review panel is handpicked and scientists who have opinions that they have expressed that have been against delisting gray wolves, and they're excluded from this peer review panel, it gives the impression that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is trying to handpick experts that will support their case for delisting instead of experts who will give an honest and well-qualified evaluation of U.S. Fish and Wildlife's
proposal. Very, very troubling. What is fueling this? Are there special interests at play that are trying to get the wolves eradicated?
Well, wolves are a very polarizing species. They invoke passionate support, but they also evoke fear and anger sometimes. We are not about continuing the wolf wars mentality. You know, we're really trying to find common ground and solutions. So, we don't necessarily like to point to anyone to kind of place blame anywhere in particular. But what we are trying to do is to share the facts about wolves and to share the facts about this delisting proposal and to ask people to speak up and to tell U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that they want gray wolves to remain on the landscape for future generations.
Now, you've mentioned that you were trying to work with ranching interests, for example, to sort of put your money where your mouth is and give them some examples of ways that livestock and wolves can coexist. Can you give us some examples?
Yes. A core part of our mission is providing funding for coexistence measures. These are things that prevent conflicts between wolves and human activities, and that includes livestock grazing. Many of the techniques that we fund are designed to prevent conflicts before they occur, and each time we're successful preventing those conflicts, it increases tolerance for wolves and other wild predators on the landscape. Some of the specific examples are funding range riders. These are people who go out and they can be with the livestock. They create a human presence in that area. And because wolves are naturally shy around humans, that alone is enough to deter them from entering an area where livestock may be grazing. We also fund fladry. That's a visual deterrent that keeps wolves from entering an area. Predator-proof fencing, which excludes predators from an area where you may be housing livestock. Livestock guardian dogs, and some creative and technologically advanced husbandry techniques that end up resulting in healthier livestock and preventing those conflicts.
Now, there's a national poll, I understand, that shows support for protecting the wolves.
Absolutely. The majority of U.S. citizens support wolf recovery. There are some vocal opponents to wolf recovery, but we're encouraging people who, if you are one of those majority of Americans who supports wolf recovery, you have an opportunity through September 11th, 2013, to provide public comment to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
That's very important. Let's repeat that. There is a deadline for public comment on this of September 11th, and you can find a link for how to submit your public comments at the California Wolf Recovery Center website, which is?
It's www.californiawolfcenter.org. You have a chance to stand up for wolves and tell U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that the job is not done.
Okay, and you can also, we'll be posting that also at the www.eastcountymagazine.org site as well. Wednesday, August 14th is a National Day of Public Action to Protect Wolves. Tell us what you have in mind for that.
A large number of conservation organizations have come together to partner to organize this National Day of Action, August 14th. And we're asking everyone to wear gray, talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, feel free to howl, but let people know that wolves are important. They have an important role in our environment, and you can take that opportunity to tell not just your friends and neighbors, but also the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that wolf recovery is important and the job is not done.
Yes. Now, as we've mentioned, there are several thousand gray wolves across the continental United States. This delisting would delist them in all 48 lower states, which is quite astonishing. One bright spot is that the Mexican gray wolf has been excluded from that delisting, and this is one of the species that you're working with at your facility in Julian. Tell us about your efforts there.
The Mexican gray wolf is the most genetically distinct subspecies, and they are the rarest. There are only about 75 of them alive in the wild today.
And at one point it was down to 7, right?
We got within 7 unrelated individuals of that subspecies being extinct. The only reason we have Mexican gray wolves alive on the landscape today is because of captive breeding efforts of facilities like the California Wolf Center. So we host and breed Mexican gray wolves in captivity, and some of our individuals are selected for release into the wild. They're being released released into Arizona and New Mexico.
How successful has that been? Have they been protected and kept safe once they were released?
Well, they've been protected, but human-caused mortality is still the number one threat to the survival of Mexican gray wolves. So this is still an uphill battle, and the job is certainly not done.
Because the rancher or someone who sees it doesn't know that it's an endangered subspecies, maybe.
Part of the issue is confusion between Mexican gray wolves and coyotes, mm-hmm. although one of the things we try to do is provide educational information to help people identify those two unique mm-hmm. individual mm-hmm. animals. But there is also illegal poaching, hunting, trapping that does cause some mortality for Mexican gray wolves.
So they could stumble into a coyote trap, for example. Now, in California, we don't have any wolves. Is that correct?
Correct. In December of 2011, a wolf named OR7, or nicknamed Journey, crossed from Oregon into California and became our first wild wolf here in almost 90 years.
Wow. So they were here historically.
Yes, absolutely. Wolves are native to the state of California, but they were completely wiped out here in the 1920s. And so OR7's Journey into California represents the very beginning stages of wolf recovery here in our home state. And that's one of the main reasons why this delisting proposal is so premature, because we have areas like the Pacific West, which includes California, where wolves are not yet recovered. So to remove federal protections from them puts the brakes on wolf recovery and potentially might prevent wolves from reclaiming areas of excellent wolf habitat where they could survive and could provide those ecological benefits that those top predators
do. Now, let's talk about the ecological benefits of large predators such as wolves. When they're removed from the ecosystem, what are some of the negative things that can happen?
Well, we tend to see their prey species overpopulate.
So deer.
And with wolves in particular, their natural prey are large ungulates or hoofed animals like deer, elk. When these populations grow too large, they tend to overgraze native vegetation. And that impacts habitat that many other species of animals depend on. It impacts the vegetation itself. So we see trees like willow and aspen, in particular riparian or river ecosystems, are negatively affected by overgrazing. It can mm-hmm. even impact the water quality.
There you go.
And that has impacts throughout a watershed.
And I would think for ranchers who do use open range lands on, say, Bureau of Land Management land, that actually could mean less foraging material, less grasses for their sheep or cattle to graze on.
It can have impacts there as well. And it's important that people understand that there are ways to coexist. There are ways to have healthy rangeland for livestock to graze, as well as healthy populations of wild ungulates and wild predators.
Now let's talk a little bit about the California Wolf Center, which is right here in Julian. It's an amazing place. Besides the Mexican gray wolves that you actually are breeding there for repopulation in the wild, I understand you also have other wolves and some educational things. Tell us about it.
We do. We have an ambassador pack of Alaskan gray wolves that we keep to help people understand about wolves in the wild. They're ambassadors for wolves in the wild, and they can speak more articulately for wolves than we ever will be able to. So people can come and visit and learn about mm-hmm. wolves and the important
Take
role
photos.
That they play in mm-hmm. the ecosystem. And certainly cameras are welcome. So education and outreach is something that we do, not just at our conservation center, but throughout the state of California. We're also mm-hmm. active in providing this proactive non-lethal funding for techniques that prevent conflicts between wolves and human activities. We host and conduct research to help us better understand wolf behavior, ecology, and what we can better do to protect them in the wild.
Very good. Well, the website again to get more information about how you can visit the California Wolf Center, how you can submit your public comments before September 11th about the proposal to delist wolves from the federal endangered species protection, and also learn more about the August 14th National Day of Action, you can visit www.californiawolfcenter.org. Erin, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. This week's lineup of activities includes art, music, history, sports, nature, wine, and more. First up, tickets are available for a couple more days for the August 17th 6th Annual Heart of Mount Helix, with the emphasis on ART. This event, which runs Saturday night from 5:30 to 10 p.m., is a fundraiser to benefit the Mount Helix Park Foundation. The entertainment headliner is the Mighty and Untouchables. Other musicians featured are the Jan Connor Trio, Lillian Palmer, and David Maldonado. Besides the live music, there will be tastings from several well-known restaurants, visual art demonstrations, silent and live auctions, and a perfect sunset. Silent auction prizes to bid on include a bay cruise for 10 on a private yacht, lunch for 2 at Thornton Winery by way of helicopter to the winery, and the ultimate San Diego safari at Lions, Tigers, and Bears. Tickets for the 6th annual Heart of Mount Helix event are pre-sale only. Sales will end August 14th. The Young Actors Theater is presenting Grease, which opens this weekend beginning on Friday and running through Sunday the 18th. It continues next weekend from August 22nd through the 25th at Encore Theater in Spring Valley, evoking Rydell High's senior class of 1959 in this rollicking musical. The shows are at 7 p.m. each day, with Saturday and Sunday 2 p.m. matinees. Tickets can be purchased online at yatsandiego.org. San Pasquale Winery is offering a paint and palette event on Wednesday, August 14th, from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. Paint, sip, and enjoy. Find your inner Picasso as you paint and have a ton of fun. They provide everything you need, including a 16-inch by 20-inch canvas, supplies, art apron, and step-by-step instructions by a local artist. Just bring yourself, no art experience required. For more information and to reserve your space, go to paintandpalette.com. Also at the San Pasquale Winery's new tasting room on La Mesa Boulevard in La Mesa, enjoy live music featuring the Mercury Street Blues Band on Saturday, August 17th from 7 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. They play a variety of music, jazz, blues, folk, and rock. Wine by the glass, cheese and crackers, and dessert are available. Seating is on a first-come, first-served basis. Mission Trails Regional Park in San Carlos will be hosting a summer twilight walk and owl prowl as dusk sets in on Saturday night, August 17th. Advance registration is required. Guests will gather at Bushy Hill parking lot across from the Kumeyaay Lake Campground entry. The walk begins at 7:30 p.m. and ends at 9:30 p.m. The Alpine Historical Society is holding their special presentation, Witness to Gettysburg, on August 18th from 2 to 3:45 p.m. at the Alpine Women's Club in Alpine. Miss Hattie Elizabeth Turner, played by Annette Hubble, tells how a town of 2,400 citizens coped with the 30,000 casualties following the epic Battle of Gettysburg. San Diego State University is set for Aztec Fan Fest, formerly known as Aztec Family Day, scheduled for Saturday, August 17th at Qualcomm Stadium. The event features Tailgate Town, a Fan Fest scrimmage, and a Meet the Team autograph session. Gates open at 3:30 p.m., and admission is free. The event begins with Tailgate Town, which includes appearances by San Diego State University players, coaches, and sponsors, as well as the San Diego State University Marching Aztecs and Cheer Team. At Cosmos Coffee Cafe in La Mesa, Jeff Berkeley and Jeffrey Joe will be performing on Thursday, August 15th at 7 p.m. Float in the pool while watching the family movie Brave this Wednesday, August 14th at the Salvation Army Croc Center. They call it Dive In Movie. The movie begins at 7:30 and the first 50 guests will receive inner tubes. The Croc Center is located on University Avenue in San Diego, just outside of La Mesa. Brouhaha Comedy has a comedy show every Wednesday at Haritna Mediterranean Restaurant on El Cajon Boulevard in La Mesa. The show runs from 7:30 to 9 p.m. This Wednesday's show features international headliner Kurt Swan, and the mixer starts at 6 p.m. with the show beginning at 7:30. On Tuesday, August 13th at 6 p.m., as part of their People Who Cook program, the Julian Public Library will be featuring frozen desserts with Jeff Jeremy from Jeremy's on the Hill. And a summer mixer where you can meet and greet with local businessmen and women in East County is hosted by the La Mesa Chamber of Commerce. The event is free for chamber members and $10 for non-members. The Summer Mixer will start at 5:30 p.m. on Wednesday, August 14th, at the Holiday Inn, 8000 Parkway Drive. All of these events and activities and more can be found in our Festival and Events section and in our calendar at www.eastcountymagazine.org. See you around, East County.
Tom Lemon is the chairman and CEO of the San Diego County Building Trades Council Family Housing Corporation. It's a nonprofit corporation that owns and operates and maintains the National City Park Apartments. Thank you for coming today, Tom.
Thanks, Iris. Thanks for having me. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the apartments themselves, some of the community outreach that we're doing, touch a little bit about a historical building that we're working on that has great ties to the community and the women's suffrage movement, as well as veterans housing and efforts to increase affordable housing throughout the region.
Can you give us a brief description of the San Diego Building County Trades Council Family Housing Corporation?
So fancy when you say it like that. It's really just the National City Park Apartments. But our vision is that we expand and provide additional family housing elsewhere in the county.
What is your success rate?
The Park Apartments is a unique facility in National City, 22 acres. And we always have all the tenants we need. So when it comes to occupancy, we're so fortunate we always have 100%. I'm always surprised sometimes when I see the report come back, it says 104%. And I'm going, how do we do that? But people move in and out in the same month. But there's a waiting list that we've had for years.
That's great. I understand it's a partnership with HUD. Is that correct?
Well, it started out that way. It was actually a developer who wanted to build affordable housing using HUD financing. He reached out to the local construction unions because he wanted the project done right the first time and done on time. And then he really gave us an opportunity to become landlords by us forming the nonprofit, the National City Park Apartments Affordable Housing. And for 40 years, we've owned, maintained, and operated it with a union workforce and provided homes for lots of San Diegans, including myself. I actually lived there as a child, spent my formative years, you know, because of where it's located. There's schools, there's two elementary schools within a couple blocks. There's a junior high school, a high school, all just right there around it. So it's a perfect location.
You have created a public-private partnership with the school district. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, it's real exciting for us. We had the opportunity to take one of our meeting halls and open it up to the school district where they're doing school training, computer labs, helping kids who aren't really in traditional schools make it through, get their GEDs. So it's nice. They're a great tenant, and it's nice to have them on site. You know, in addition to that, we also have a daycare center where we have First Five. So we're covering both sides of the spectrum out there.
Also, I understand many residents have secured permanent housing. What percentage of those residents now reside in East County?
About half of the folks that leave our apartments leave because they're moving into their own homes. I'm sure because of affordability in the East County that some of them are actually moving out this way.
You recently purchased the old VFW hall. What are your plans for that?
You know, you referred to it as the VFW Hall, but you got to go way back. It was originally in 1911, the Olivewood Women's Club, which was built specifically because the founder of National City didn't want his wife to have to travel all the way from National City to San Diego to be part of the women's social scene. But what's exciting about that place is Susan B. Anthony started the suffrage movement, and there was a lot of discussion there about it. And because it's such a neat historic building, we're restoring it to its original luster, and we're going to utilize it as a community gathering place for National City and the surrounding area.
There are many veterans in the East County who are searching for housing. I understand that you're planning to build some veterans housing. Can you tell us about that?
So National City is a big Navy town, and certainly we like that about being located there. And we historically have had a lot of military folks in our housing. But our buildings are 40 years old now, and we're actually looking to take down some and go vertical and actually create some affordable veterans housing, since there's going to be so many young men and women coming back from overseas.
Do you have any future plans to build any other median low-income apartments in East County similar to the National City Park apartments?
That's really our long-term vision, is to take the asset that we have and grow it and create pockets of affordability in other parts of the county. And certainly we're looking at East County. It'd be great if we could get some traction with some of the local electeds out here and get some help from them.
The Family Housing Corporation has been active throughout San Diego County for many years now. Can you tell us about some of the programs that you're involved in?
Well, one of the things we're really excited about right now is we're participating in the South County Visiting Project. We're looking at changing the way South County becomes more integrated in a bigger city. I mean, Chula Vista currently is the second largest city in the county, so we're really interested in leaving a footprint there. We're also providing scholarships for folks. We make a generous contribution to the Center for Policy Initiatives, which is a think tank for how to move progressive agenda forward. There's several other folks that come to us on a smaller basis, but we just really fortunate to be able to help out as people ask for donations and such.
How do people find out more about the National City Park Apartments?
You know, it's really a great kept secret, and this is exciting to actually be able to get on the air and talk about it a little bit. We have a website, San Diego Affordable Housing. We just recently took applications and have a backlog of folks that want to move in. So I guess to answer your question more succinctly, we really haven't told many folks about what we're doing, but this is one of the opportunities here being on your show.
Great. Tom, I want to thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Sierra Robinson, bringing you a special report on new technologies in wind energy. Wind turbines have raised safety concerns locally after a multi-ton blade fell off a wind turbine in Ocotillo. In Campo, industrial wind turbines blew apart in a storm, hurling heavy blade debris. Such accidents pose risks when large turbines are located near homes, roads, and parks. Turbine blades also pose a danger to birds and bats. Plus, neighbors of large wind turbines have complained about the whooshing sound of blades as well as annoying shadow flicker. But now, some manufacturers are testing out a new generation of bladeless wind turbines. These designs hold promise to potentially reduce risks to wildlife and also eliminate some, though not all, of the problems for people living near turbines. Bladeless turbines may be smaller in scale, lessening impacts on views and potentially reducing noise. For example, Shearwind's bladeless, funnel-shaped wind turbine, called Invalex, channels wind through a narrow passage that the company claims will produce more energy than a standard turbine, and that it can do so with lower wind speeds. That means the bladeless turbines could be used in urban areas, sparing natural habitats from destruction. Safon Energy, a Tunisian company, also boasts a bladeless turbine, which converts wind power to energy through back-and-forth motion using pistons. The Safonian model is also designed to store excess energy, providing power for times when the wind does not blow. The San Diego City Council has unanimously approved a master plan for the San Diego River Park. The plan, backed by the San Diego River Park Foundation, will ultimately create a series of parks and trails stretching from Julian in the mountains of East County to the Pacific Ocean.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interests, the people's interests, not special interests. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection,
and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.